you know, sort of the instant society, right? And those are the headline grabbers type thing. But the reality of the world, and we all know this, is that if we want to be good at something, it's a process, and it takes time and commitment.
Welcome to the Low Tide Boys, a swim run podcast. I am Chip.
And I'm Chris, and this is episode 32. Let me just say, this is going to be, this. I think we're journalists at this point. On the show, wow, we have Jerry Rodriguez of Tower 26 and Emma-Kate Lindbury of Tower 26 and Fellow Press and Triathlete Magazine. They co-wrote the book, Triathlon Swimming, Master Open Water Swimming with the Tower 26 Method. The book came out a couple weeks ago. We already have them on the show, people. We yes. are journalists. The book's available now. We'll link it in the show notes. But yeah, well, more on this later, but we're super stoked to have them on the show this week.
Absolutely. And another thing that we're very stoked about, and a big thank you to everyone that's listened. If you listen to just one episode, you probably won't hear this, but or if you listen to every episode three or four times, we have amassed in total since we started 10,000 downloads plus.
Yeah.
At the time of this recording.
A couple days ago.
Which is a pretty cool.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, again, we've said this time and time again, but we started this just literally so our friends would kind of stop asking us about it so we could just point them in an area. And it took hold so quickly and really just took off. And the reception from everybody, honestly, I'm floored. And I think once a week, I at least talk to Chris and I'm like, can you believe that XYZ that has to do with the podcast? And I still can't get over it. But anyway, enough of showboating. On to our training update.
Sure. We did another swim run.
It's like our thing now.
Yeah, like Saturday swim runs.
It's like we're a swim run team or something.
Someone who was a Catalina said, oh, we saw you guys in the water.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was pretty cool. And I'm doing this ridiculous bad idea 7-day challenge.
Share a little bit about the One Punch Man challenge.
Yeah, so One Punch Man is some anime out of Japan. It's really funny, incidentally. It's available on Netflix if you want to check it out. I am not endorsed by
this episode is not presented by Netflix.
So in that show, the superhero basically gets his superpowers by doing a rigorous workout that he just does every day with the same workout every day, and he basically unlocked
a superpower.
Superpower, and his workout was 100 push-ups, 100 sit-ups, 100 squats, and a 10K run every day. Like, that's all he did. So this has become a thing. People do this workout. People have done it for 30 days, 60 days. Some people even try to do it for like a year.
Jesus.
I'm doing it for 7 days. So I convinced my buddy, John, who's always down for bad ideas, to mm-hmm. do it with me. And yeah.
Winner of feats of endurance for running around his block.
First winner of feats. He inspired the category. Feats of endurance. Yeah.
Speaking of that, we'll go a little out of order here according to our notes, but the bumper stickers are in. So feats of endurance are here. You may have seen on our Instagram. I gave a little shout out this week on feats of endurance. We did something a little bit different. So usually Chris and I will kind of through the week we'll mentally note any cool adventures that people have been on. But one caught our eye at the tail end of last week, and it was our really good friend Beak from Team Envol Baywatch, who was on episode, Chris will know,
four
or something. We also raced with them in Otolo Catalina, him and his partner Blake, great dudes. He did this really awesome adventure, and Chris had the idea and said, what if he just sent in a clip describing the adventure? So we have our first audio submission.
Yes. So for your listening pleasure, here is Beak.
Hello, Low Tide Boys. This is Kavika from Team Envol Baywatch. For your feats of endurance consideration, I present to you the peer-to-peer quest that I completed last Tuesday. So once a year, the lifeguards in Orange County gather together for an underground event. We start at the San Clemente Pier, and we travel north to the next pier, which is the Balboa Pier in Newport Beach. Overall, this covers 27 miles, and you can break it up into swimming and running however you want. You run every beach, and you swim around every rocky point. If the rocks are too technical or too steep to climb, you just swim around them. And they do this every year, showing up on the first Tuesday in August. There's no advertising. It's just an adventure. So you never know how many people are going to show up. Sometimes there's only a handful. Sometimes there's a couple dozen people. But you get there on the first Tuesday in August, and you just take the adventure from San Clemente Pier all the way north to Balboa Pier. Along the way, there are four separate cliff jumps, the highest being 45 feet. There are times where you can swim through sea caves. You stop by to dip in the man-made saltwater pools that are filled with the tides. There are arches that you climb through, do a little bit of spelunking. And as always, we stop by some memorials to pay respects to guards that have passed. This is not a race. No one is left behind. You just join in the camaraderie and experience nature by getting from one pier to the other, from one place to the other, not letting anything get in your way. It's an awesome day where you meet a lot of new people. And it took us in total about 6 hours with some aid station breaks. And it was an awesome adventure. I highly recommend it to anybody who is in the area on the first Tuesday of August. There's no information. You just show up and you do it. So please consider that for Feats of Endurance this week. Thank you.
Yeah. That was just a crazy.
Yeah. So needless to say,
45 foot jumps off.
Yeah. Needless to say, he was going to get it at some point. He definitely earned it for this one. And here's his acceptance speech.
I'm speechless. This is amazing. I'd like to thank the Academy for this award, to my wife that always believed in me, that knew that I could one day achieve this feat of endurance, to my teammate Blake and my other teammates at Team Envol. So grateful for you guys. Thank you to the Low Tide Boys for always posting those buoy memes to inspire me to do better. I believe in all of you. I love all of you. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Love it. That is great. Thanks again, Beak from Team Envol Baywatch. And don't forget to get in on the Feats of Endurance fun. Join our Strava club. We're almost at 100 members there. So invite all your friends and, you know, let the kudos reign over thee.
So for shout outs this week, I had a very interesting experience at Costco in Novato, California.
And this layers on to the thing of this whole everything. Situation is so
it's
surreal.
Ridiculous. So I'm fully branded, wearing my Low Tide Boys shirt. I think I was listening to a podcast or something, walking through, and someone, you know, buying
with your mask on,
whatever, my mask on, everything. Yep. He points at my shirt, and I just give him like the yeah, like the V, all right. And so he clearly wants to talk to me. So I'm like, oh, I guess I'll talk to this guy. He proceeds to tell me that he learned about the show from his son, and that he's been listening to it, and he thinks it's really funny. And then he asks me, oh, well, how to, you know, how come you have a shirt from the show?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm Chris. And he was like, oh, man, that's so crazy. Like, it was totally ridiculous. But obviously, I had to tell Chipper right away. So if you've been seeing some memes about the Low Tide Boys at Costco,
paparazzi.
That's the basis for that.
We're jumping on that. But
yeah, so this week's shout-out goes to the dude from Costco.
So send us an Instagram or an email or something so we can properly introduce ourselves. And you will not forever remain the dude from Costco. So this week, our newest column in Triathlete Magazine is out now, and it's all about how to pick the best swim-run team name.
Yeah.
So there's two... And then you have the kind of American...
Whoa. Don't spoil it for people. Just bleep that out, okay?
I'll bleep it out. It won't happen.
Check it out online, triathlete.com.
And in other news, we keep getting submissions. We got some more submissions for our International Swim Run Adventure Guide. Thank you for sending those out. We're sort of collecting a couple so that we have a nice bank to go publish. So that way it's not, oh, we have this huge area on our site, but there's one thing in there. Yeah. We have a couple submissions now, so keep sending those in. I know we have our own to submit as well. But send those in. That's right on the homepage of the site there.
Yeah, and I guess in other news, our next episode of Gear Talk with the Swim Run Labs will be coming out pretty soon, and we'll be talking all about the barefoot style running, Bevo Barefoot, ESC Tempest, the quote the ultimate amphibious trail shoe. So check that out. We're also going to be sharing some updates from previous gear that we've been trying. And I recently gave the VIG a run.
The ARC VIG.
The ARC Sports VIG.
Got some first impressions.
Got some first impressions for people.
So if you have any gear that you want us to review, shoot us an email at lowtideboys@gmail.com. And we'll also throw up the Instagram stories. We've collected a bunch of responses there, so really appreciate everyone sending those things in. But yeah, let's, without further ado, let's dive right into the Tower 26 interview. And a couple things here. So the book's called Triathlon Swimming, and we understand that we are swim runners, but we all know you all are capable enough to see the similarities and the translation on how certain things could translate or can't translate to swim run.
Right.
So just keep that in mind as you're doing it. Also, we found out Tower 26 has a multitude of coaches. Some of them are swim runners. So we thought it'd be really cool. We know everybody has tons of open water swimming questions, how it is specific for swim run. So we wanted to put it out there that we're going to have an AMA style, Ask Me Anything style format with one of the Tower 26 or some of the Tower 26 coaches. So you can email us your questions. We tried to hit on some stuff which we know are, I guess, hot topics like, hey, if you don't have pool access, what should you do? How should you kind of structure your workout if you only have 45 minutes to swim in the lane or different things like that. So we tried to cover some of those in the interview for you. But if you have more, shoot us emails or Instagram works as well.
Yeah. So if you don't know who Jerry Rodriguez is, he's a huge name. Tower 26. He's an open water swimmer forever.
40 something years.
He's the one that the pros go to when they want to save time. And all triathlon swimming is open water swimming. So when his new book came out, and I've been following him for a while. We were like, oh yeah, let's try to be journalists and see if we can get this book and read it and then interview him. Everything worked out, which was pretty cool. So he's on the show with his co-author, Emma Kate. So you get an interesting perspective of someone who actually went through his process. And I think there's a lot of nuggets in here. Jerry's a really interesting guy, just tells it like it is. And yeah, I think you'll enjoy this one.
You definitely will.
So enjoy. Okay.
Hope your ears have fun.
With us today, we have Jerry Rodriguez and Emma Kate Lindbury, open water swim guru, former pro triathlete. They wrote this book called Triathlon Swimming, Master Open Water Swimming with the Tower 26 Method. Thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, guys.
So before we deep dive into this book, which we definitely want to go there, do you guys want to tell us a little bit about yourselves, how you sort of got to the point where you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I'll let Jerry take that one.
No, BK, please. You start off and I'll try and touch up a little bit.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I was about a few years into my pro triathlon career. I started swimming at Tower 26 in California. I moved from the UK to the US, and Jerry obviously took me under his wing and I swam at Tower 26 for the best part of 3 or 4 seasons. And obviously learned a ton while there and got a great insight into how Jerry coaches, his training philosophies, all that good stuff. And I was coming towards the end of my pro career and have a background as a journalist and was looking to kind of re-enter that world. And at the same time, Jerry was starting to talk with VeloPress about this book project. And it all kind of almost seamlessly came together. Yeah.
We just heard so many things about Tower 26. It's almost like a mythical thing. I was actually, this was years ago when I was, was type A triathlete guy. And I was in LA for work and I missed the workout. I had it all planned. I was going to arrive a day early so I could go to Santa Monica, go and be part of the workout. And I couldn't make it happen. So I was bummed, but Jerry, obviously you're super well known in the sport. Pros, amateur, age groupers go to you to get help in swimming. Where did this drive to kind of take on this journey for everyone else? Like where did that come from?
You know, I'm one of these lucky guys that grew up as an athlete, as a, from a kid in the Caribbean, and we swam in open water from the time I was 10 years old. And we did that several months a year, three or four times a week. So I did that for, gosh, 7 or 8 years before I left Trinidad to move to the United States. And then right as we were finishing, as I was finishing college, my last year in 1983, I just finished competing. We started a triathlon program called Team Malibu. There were a group of us. And that was the my introduction into triathlon, and started coaching immediately. We started a program. And fast forward, I'm a slow learner. It took me 30 years to figure out how to write a book on triathlon swimming, but finally it came together. And if I were to back up from about 2008-ish or so, I was exclusively coaching triathletes only. Finally moved from coaching, where we had lots of master swimmers and so on, to only triathletes. And when Tower 26 formed, which was an entity that I formed in 2010, that was exclusive triathlon also. So it was really easy to take that knowledge base from being a kid, competing in swimming, competing in open water racing, and coaching for lots of, you know, 30-something years, and then starting that triathlon program in the early 80s, and now finally being able to hook up with Emma Kate and had her, you know, ran through our program, like she mentioned, for 3 years, 3 or 4 years, actually. And then and it was, the timing was right. I was in Boulder, Colorado, talking to the publisher. And then I remembered I was having dinner, actually, with Emma Kate and her husband that night. And they were looking for somebody to actually write the book, because I said, you really don't want me to write the book. I'll provide the knowledge base, but we need somebody who with really good writing skills. So Emma Kate happened to be the right person, and here is the book a few years later.
Yeah, that is such a cool story about everything, just multiple people being in the right place at the right time and the right point in your career and your coaching career. So what a great story. What would be good to kind of get into now is sort of, we're cracking the book open right now, physically and literally, and Let's kind of set the stage here. What is the Tower 26 methodology of how to master kind of the open water swimming? Like, I guess if you had to say, like, what's your elevator pitch about Tower 26?
Well, it's, you know, in simplistic terms, it's from 10 years old till now. So it's almost 50 years. I have obviously a tremendous amount of experience swimming and racing in open water, and then since the early 80s coaching triathletes. So it's a combination of all of those years brought together in with obviously my knowledge base into this book of what's best for triathletes. And that's the key thing. It's although it's open water swimming, but the book is specifically for triathletes. In other words, if someone was going to the Olympic Games to race in open water, this would obviously be of tremendous benefit, but it would even be of more benefit to the triathlete. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, somebody who's just swimming in a master's program, it would be a little less benefit. And definitely someone who's competitive age group swimming or even NC2A swimming, this wouldn't have a significant amount of value to them, because their events are, you know, forget the exact number, but 95% of their events, I believe, are 4 or 5 minutes and shorter. Whereas most triathlon events, even if you did a sprint triathlon, it's several minutes long, 7 or 8 minutes for the shortest swim, mm-hmm. all the way up to perhaps even 2 hours for the longest swim. So you've got a book with all my years of experience of coaching put together in very simplistic ways to understand.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciated how kind of approachable and the if you want to say kind of barrier to entry for this book and what you're talking about was, it was really accessible. And I liked how you touched on, of all the athletes you have within Tower 26 program, you know, I think some people kind of get really intimidated about, oh man, he's only coaching the really pointy end, the cream of the crop age group and pros. But you actually kind of touched on that the majority of your membership is actually, I think what you referred to as like level 2 to 4 swimmer, or do I have that backwards a little bit?
So we break it down into 4 categories, sort of easy to understand. And category 1 or level 1 being your super elite athletes. And let me back up. level one of the swimming segment. So, for instance, somebody could be a female 225 marathoner elite in the world, or 210 marathoner elite male in the world, but be a level four swimmer. So if you're a level one swimmer, it's super competitive. Let's put it into definitive terms. Say someone's swimming 27, 26 minutes or faster for a half Ironman, and in the upper 50s on faster for an Ironman swim, that would be our level one athletes. And only, I would say, somewhere in the range of less than 10%. So around 5 to 7% of the people that we coach fall into that category. And then level two would be the next level. And that's sort of fairly elite, still good, very, very good swimmers, triathletes who have a good swim. That would be level two. And that's about 25% of the people that we coach. And then the bulk are levels three and four, which you can use the word beginning swimming athletes, or those with moderate foundational background in swimming. And that's two-thirds of the folks that we coach. So the majority are folks, you know, who need the type of help that this book has.
My sense of the book, and one of the themes that I read throughout it, was the fact that you need to commit to this. It's almost like learning another language. Like, it's going to take some time. It's a 12-month program where you cycle through different phases. And if you really want to get faster and more confident, or whatever your goal is as a triathlete, or even just an open water swimmer, which for swim runners, that's probably a better analogy.
Yeah.
Like, it takes a decent amount of commitment, and which is mentioned throughout the book. But can you touch on that a little bit? Kind of like ideal scenario commitment, and then time crunched scenario commitment.
Yeah. You know, similar to life in general. I mean, you want to be good at something, and good doesn't mean winning. Okay. Good means being the best that you can be. We have these nice little sort of fancy magazine covers that MKH's familiar with, and I'm familiar with as a former magazine owner and publisher, that, you know, get abs in 30 days, you know, own real estate in 60 days, become a millionaire overnight, whatever it is, all these quick little
punchlines. The silver bullets.
Right. You know, sort of the instant society, right? And those are the headline grabbers type thing. But the reality of the world, and we all know this, is that if we want to be good at something, it's a process. And it takes time and commitment. And swimming, being of the three sports, being the most difficult technically, and therefore requires a little bit more demand to it, takes longer. So, and also the sport of triathlon has sort of bucketed itself over the years into little 8 to 10 or 12 week programs, which you see in other books, or in online opportunities to, here's an online coaching plan. Just follow this for 10 weeks and you're ready for your race. Well, again, that's the get abs in 30 days type, you know, trick. But it really doesn't fully prepare you if you want to be pretty good at what you're doing. And especially if you want to make the sport as a lifestyle, meaning not just a one and done race. It's not, I just want to do that Alcatraz in your guys' area close by. Mm-hmm. I just want to do that Alcatraz triathlon one time and then I'm done. If that's what you want, then this book's not for you. But if you want to look to make the sport as part of your lifestyle and integrate it into what you do on a day-to-day basis, week-to-week, year-to-year, and even take your family and build vacations around it, perhaps events around the world, when we're allowed to do that again, this is COVID time.
Yeah.
But then this book is there for you. It's your roadmap on how to build in the swim segment. And here's a one-year plan on how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's so great, and I think that's why it resonated so. The book resonated with Chris and I so much, is that, you know, we identify as we're swim runners. You know, that's who we are. We got a show about it. We're looking to do every race, learn everything we can about it, just the same as if you ask somebody and they're like, "Yeah, I'm a triathlete," or "I'm an open water swimmer," or whatever it is. It does take that large commitment on multiple levels of life, I guess, even. But yeah, so let's kind of get right into it. And I thought, once you started talking a little bit about the training and methodology, I think people get really excited, and you know, I'm guilty of this as well. And I think it's maybe a triathlete thing or a swim runner thing, about all the little toys and gears and gadgets to buy, like, ooh, I need these new paddles or the snorkel. And your book definitely prescribes a lot of toys and gear. But your number one thing that you said before you could start really even working on technique, you need just yards or meters on your shoulders before you could even start thinking about that. So I was hoping that you'd be able to go into that.
Yeah, you know, let's take Emma Kate, who has a swing background. Her approach when she joined us would be a little bit different than most folks who don't have the type of background that Emma Kate did, because she was a competitive swimmer growing up. So once she came across from the UK to join us, she didn't need as much of that foundational training, so to speak, because she had, I mean, I'm speaking on your behalf, Emma Kate, probably swam anywhere from 40 to 60,000 meters a week during certain phases of your training season. Would that be right?
Yeah, I started out life as a competitive swimmer at age 11, and then all the way through to college, and a little bit into college was swimming, high volume. Definitely had the engine and that critical technique background that you definitely need.
So Emma, so what was it that made you want to go work with Jerry? Like, what was the skill set that you were trying to develop? Was it just open water stuff, or?
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure. Having swum in the UK only in lakes and had very little ocean experience, it was definitely that open water. The exposure to open water and just that, that randomness and volatility of the ocean that you have to learn throughout. Again, you know, speaking to what you were just talking about, it takes consistency, it takes longevity to learn how to swim in the ocean, how to swim in open water, in fact. And it's so different to swimming up and down, following the black line in the pool.
So EK specifically needed the open water ingredient to it. But when most folks start triathlon in general, even if it's run swim, you know, a portion of the two legs of the three in triathlon, as you guys do, if you don't have that swim background and you now started off swimming, trying to work on technique, which is sort of the thing that most people do right away. It's like, I got to go get a swim lesson to learn how to learn how to swim. Well, most folks do know how to swim already. And if you were to go out Chip and Chris, if you guys were, if you hadn't run at all for 5 years and you went out on your first day to run, well, what would happen in the first 15 or 20 minutes?
I'd be tired and probably stop.
Exactly. You'd be tired. You'd stop. You'd be high heart rate. It'd be a slight hill and you go, I'm just going to walk the rest of this hill. Or I'm going to turn around and just go downhill. That's common. But what you don't do is then go home and go on the internet and look for a running coach to give you a running lesson, right? You've recognized that, hey, I'm just unfit and I'm going to have to put some time into to gain my fitness back. Well, everyone does just the opposite with swimming. If they go out and swim, they know how to swim, the ones who do. They go to the local pool, they start swimming and realize after the example, 15 minutes, whatever it may be, or even shorter, oh, this is really difficult. I'm really fatigued. I got to go find a coach to give me a swim lesson. Well, it's the same as running. You're just not fit. It has nothing to do with needing a swim lesson yet. You don't have any specific muscular endurance, period. For swimming, and perhaps if you weren't doing anything at all, you have no endurance whatsoever. So you just have to swim, and you need to do that just like for running. You'd have to go run two or three times or four times a week. Maybe it's 15 minutes and then 20 minutes, and you build up. And after 30 days, hey, you build some running endurance. Well, it's the same that applies to swimming. And when you've built that swimming endurance, then you're able to absorb any type of swimming instruction that you may be given. But if you went after the swimming instruction first and the instructor gives you something to do, you'd swim a couple of lengths and you're fatigued. You can't really absorb the instruction. So we need to build the endurance, then layer in the instruction, and then it's a dance after that.
Yeah, that makes – I mean, that just seems – as you say it, that seems obvious, right? But it's almost like it's not obvious.
I can't believe I hadn't thought about that before, but the running versus swimming analogy is so true.
Yes, for sure.
That is, I mean, that just hit the nail on the head right there. And I think when people hear it, they'll be like, oh, you know what? You're totally right. Yeah. Like, you don't go, yeah, totally.
So I guess, like, then the next piece, and I'm specifically looking at chapter 4, is just proving to you guys that I actually read the book.
We got our crib notes ready.
Actually read the book.
We got a private joke there.
Okay. It's well, we'd love to hear it, but it's okay. It's like, then we're talking technique, and I think breaking it down to tautness, alignment, and then propulsion makes total sense. But what we see is like that requires being able to have access to a pool, mm-hmm. and hopefully access to a pool where you have enough time to do some of these sets. The pool that we're at, we have 55 minutes. That's like, it's great. We have our own lane. I hope we can continue to reserve.
There's
one positive thing of COVID is the ability to reserve your lane at the pool.
Yes.
Like, it's so fantastic.
Post-COVID world. Woo.
I hope that that continues post-COVID. But yeah, so are some of these techniques this is a multi-layered question, so I'm sorry, but can these techniques be practiced in open water? Is there a way you'd adjust this?
Or dry land, potentially?
Dry land, yeah, depending on sort of people's individual scenarios that they're dealing with now.
So let's take that in a couple of parts, and I'm going to take note of that for a moment, but I'm going to let Emma Kate sort of give her little chapter four.
Let's hear the chapter four.
Oh, yeah. Well, chapter four. Okay, chapter four was the very last chapter of the book to be completed.
Oh.
And I think at one point it was over 10,000 words long.
Wow.
Jerry actually wanted to write a book that was just chapter four.
The book, chapter four,
called it chapter
by Jerry
four.
Yeah. Rodriguez.
Well, because it's technique and there's so much nuance to it, we can do an entire book just on chapter four. So to Emma Kate's point, to get it to 10,000 words, and then the publisher said, that's too long.
Yeah, and it was just the one chapter that Jerry and I just, over the course of writing the book, we established a pretty good workflow and, you know, production process, mm-hmm. and, you know, edit, write, edit, review, write, edit, review. And there are always different chapters bouncing back and forth between us at different stages, you know, of readiness. And but chapter four is just this one that went into the ether. Like, I sent it over to Jerry and then I don't know what happened, you know. But it was because it was such a mega chapter and obviously of such great importance. The technique, you know, the technical chapter is kind of what underpins the whole book. So but that's our inside joke. But yeah, so everything became about chapter four, and the book wasn't done for a while because of chapter four just, you know, hanging out there.
Well, chapter four also has the most photos.
I don't know how many pages the book is. Maybe it's a couple hundred or something like that. But
yeah,
the mere fact that we can do at least a couple hundred pages on chapter four only kind of addresses the difficulty that mm-hmm. chapter four gave us to be able to try to condense it down. And then to your specific question of, well, could you practice chapter four in open water, and or how would I practice, or could I just do it on land only? So the answer is no and no in simplistic terms and dead to the point.
Yeah.
We're land creatures, so we don't really have any access or any muscular awareness of how to manage our bodies, neuromuscular awareness of how to manage our bodies in water. So trying to then practice a skill set on land and then transfer that to open water, any type of water, is not going to work. We have to actually practice it in the water. So for those who, given the timing of our interview, that don't have pool access or open water access, it's obviously going to be very difficult because you need to be in water. And then from a safety perspective, you want to do this in a pool rather than open water, because you want to be able to learn the skills first. Then you want to be able to learn the open water skills, because there are specific skills related to open water, especially if you're doing a triathlon or a run swim. And those are practiced in the pool, and then they're finished off or polished in open water. So the process would be pool first, build the foundation, learn the skills in the specific, Chris, when you mentioned tautness, alignment, propulsion, those are the technical foundational pieces. Learn those, train those, layer on open water, and then export that, do that in the pool, sorry, and then export that to open water. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So that's really helpful. And just as a footnote, chapter four is 50 pages long.
Title? Because people are going to be...
It's called Technique.
Technique.
Technique. Yeah, and in fact, there is one dry land exercise in there that's all about stabilization and core activation, which is kind of what underpins tautness. So if you are without a pool, there are some solutions, but yeah, like right. Jerry says, these are things that need to be done in the water.
Yeah, it's not going to replicate it. So it sounds like you wouldn't recommend this for open water. What if you do have some pool access, but you're time crunched? Would you just take kind of do like the shorter sets that you guys have in the like the level four, because it's less time, kind of stuff.
Well, or 55 minutes, as you were mentioning, it's plenty of time. I mean, you can build terrific foundation and endurance with 45 minutes two or three times a week if you're consistent. And that's the key, is being consistent. So I think some of those workouts in there may be a bit longer, so you would just trim them, but you would keep the foundational pieces of them in, anything related to, in the beginning, the technical pieces. And then once you nail those down, the foundational pieces of the training after. So after that, you keep the main set in place, and then you could trim, because some of those workouts may be 60 to 75 minutes long. Right. So if you only had 45 or 50 and you've nailed down the technique portion, then trim the technique pieces, trim the warm-ups, and just do the main set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I love that sort of idea to trim, or you know, structure the workout for obviously kind of what works for you. And I've been following, and I think it's really great that you actually give not like one or two throwaway workouts. Like you have multiple workouts for different, you know, if you're doing a 1 minute 100 or whatever, up to like a two minute 100, you're giving all sorts of range of workouts, which I think is really awesome about this this book. But yeah, structuring the workout. And I have found, as I've been starting to follow these, I'm feeling that with the technique portion, or if I'm focusing on being really taught during the technique part, I feel that translates better to my main set workout, because I've sort of reminded my body about how it's supposed to be for the remainder of the workout. Is that sort of the methodology behind that?
Exactly.
That sounds perfect.
Emma Kay, he nailed it, didn't he?
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, yes, that's exactly what we were hoping.
And just to close the loop on Chris, I think what he was getting at, so we're in COVID times, not everybody has access to a lap pool. So from what I'm hearing from both Jerry and Emma Kate is that if you're time crunched or you don't have access to a pool, maybe work on sort of getting your endurance back in open water while you can. And then when the lap pool opens, then that's when you bring in the technique part of the book, along with the endurance that you've kind of been rebuilding, I guess, from not being able, from if you were in shelter in place or whatever the situation is. Is that accurate, Tower 2016?
Yeah.
That would work, sure.
Cool.
So so there's an interesting feature about swim run is that, you know, the whole point is to get from A to B as quickly as possible. So there's use of paddles, hand paddles, and the bigger the better. They look like a dinner plate. You're doing great, because it increases propulsion. And then also like a very large pool buoy that essentially gives you tremendous hip flotation and alignment or whatever.
But you're also wearing your shoes. And you're tied to somebody else.
Yeah, no big deal.
It's a couple variables going on here.
I have done one swim run event.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, awesome.
It was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I can definitely identify with all of those things.
So I feel like using a giant pool buoy and hand paddles and open water, that was a new thing for me.
Yes.
Would you, if that's kind of the point of the sport, is there anything you guys would recommend in terms of how would you adapt your methodology for swim run, kind of taking into account that there's all this, you know, extra propulsion and extra buoyancy that's thrown in?
I haven't quite yet understood the great need for these extra buoys. If you simply wore really good flotation pants, I'm not sure if extra buoys add any, have any additional benefit. And then you have to drag it along with you, right? You've got to carry it while you're running also.
Yeah. Let's have the fun though.
Well, if it's about trying to create a nuisance for your partner also, then sure, go ahead and strap another buoy on. But that's the one I haven't figured out as to why so many folks are doing that, because I'm not sure if it's needed. As far as the paddles, I understand the value of having a larger surface area. And for some folks, that may create greater propulsion. But again, it's only going to create greater propulsion if you've practiced with it. So don't show up an event day with these dinner plates or trash can lids and think it's going to give you greater propulsion, because you wouldn't have the muscular endurance to even
handle
generate
it.
Too many arm strokes exactly. So just make sure it's practiced. Yeah.
I would say, when I did the one swim run that I did, I hadn't been doing a ton of swimming with paddles on, so I actually didn't race with with paddles. And I was one of the very few people on the start line without paddles strapped to my wrists. And everybody was like, you don't have paddles on? What's going on? But I survived. It was okay. It was good.
Yeah, I'm sure you did great.
Probably smoked them.
Yeah, so but so that's really helpful to hear. I think one, what swim runners would push back on that, Jerry, is that because of all the running that's involved, typically swimming,
save the legs.
Like swimming will be 17% of a race or 20% of the race, that the material of the wetsuit that they wear needs to be thinner in the thigh area, so you don't get that buoyancy you get from like a thick wetsuit, because that would actually impede running.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if there is these tools that, let's just for the sake of argument, just assume that a high percentage of swim runners are using paddles and buoys and wearing shoes for that matter during the race, what are your kind of thoughts, and this is open to Emma Kate or whoever wants to answer it, what are your thoughts about incorporating that gear in your lap pool workouts?
Yes, for sure, on a few occasions, because you don't want to be getting into the wherever you're starting the race, whether you're starting in a lake, in wherever, you don't want to be, you know, the gun go off and the first time you are learning to figure out how to swim in shoes, which I tell you, I found very peculiar. You don't want that first experience to be on race day, which is a common theme throughout the book too. You know, you want to have everything familiar and, you know, have everything practiced. So yeah, I did a few swims, actually tested out different sneakers I was going to wear. And, you know, had a few different pairs that I thought might be good, and tried all those out, and tried out I had a swim run wetsuit that I tested out. And so I would definitely advocate practicing everything in the lap pool. Yeah, you might look a bit goofy, but hey, we're kind of used to it in our sport.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. There's actually a line in the book that I just want to quote. I think I put like a million stars next to it. This is just because it's race day doesn't mean your body will suddenly be able to reach new heights of performance. I mean, that's on page 92 if anyone's following along at home. I think that is the greatest sentence I've ever read.
There you go. That's what we meant. That's totally encapsulated there.
I mean, it's the greatest sentence I've ever read.
Well, let's take a pole vaulter, okay? A pole vaulter has got to show up at workout with his or her pole vault, right? They just don't do running as part of their training, nor does the hurdler just run laps to be fit. They have to learn how to run over hurdles. So you have to incorporate and be able to utilize all the tools that you're going to be using on event day into your training. And especially for a triathlete and a swim runner, where you don't have as much time to dedicate to your sport as a specific swimmer. Elite swimmers, they're swimming 20 hours a week. Elite runners, they're running 12 to 18 hours a week. Folks may have 6, 8, 10 hours a week at the most. So how do you now garner the biggest return on your time investment? Well, you better make sure that you're practicing with those tools that you're going to be racing with. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah.
And make sure you get shoes that are floatable. I mean, some folks haven't figured that out yet.
They drain today, well, too.
Don't get the ones that sink your feet to the bottom.
Yeah, that would be... Yeah, you don't want to wear those.
As Matt Dixon, I know we're all familiar with him at least, like a donkey dipped in cement, I believe, is one of his go-to.
Well, exactly. Those would be the donkey shoes.
Which is how I feel.
Wear your donkey shoes.
Every time I get in the water sometimes. We've been talking about the lap pool, but this book's about open water. So let's get there. What are some key things? And I know the answer, but let's just for the audience. What's some kind of key differences of why it's important to have regular open water swimming practice?
Well, Emma Kate should take this first, because she came from the swimming background and then all of a sudden realized, wait a minute, there's something different here.
Yeah.
So,
let's hear it.
Yeah, I was very well practiced in swimming up and down and following the black line. And obviously in the lap pool, you never get too much, you never get a current, you rarely get in close proximity, unless you've got somebody who's got a super, super wide arm swing, you very rarely get hit. You've got nothing to follow on the bottom of the ocean, whereas obviously in the pool, you just have to watch the tiles go by. Yeah, and there's all kinds of marine life in the ocean. There's all kinds of factors that may affect anxiety and, you know, what you're focusing on. There's just a long, long list of variables that can change on any given day when you swim in open water. And none of those variables are really factors at all when you dive into a lap pool. So that's why we advocate spending time every week swimming in open water and, you know, rehearsing and getting familiar with all these different variables.
Well, let's take the most basic one, the water itself. In the pool, you're in a fixed tank, a certain length, mm-hmm. a fixed temperature. Most facilities are 78 to 82 degrees. And you've got nice, fat, juicy lane lines. And that water is calm and placid. And then if you're in a really nice pool, there's an overflow gutter system where the water flows into the gutters. And really, there's no waves whatsoever in the pool. So you've got this static environment. Now let's go to open water, and especially if it's a race situation and you're starting off with 40, 50, 60, or if it's the Ironman, 2,000 of your closest friends. What do you think that's like? That's got nothing in concert with what you were practicing in the fixed environment. So we're just two completely different things. So we're going to have adaptation to the latter one, being open water.
I guess that'd be like comparing running the 400 on the track versus going on a trail ultra marathon or something. I mean, it's the same basic thing, but it's not even close to being the same. I think.
Right, exactly.
And Chris and I guess we've been lucky enough to be swimming almost 4 or 5 times a week. But one of those we always are dedicating to an outdoor swim run session where maybe for 2 to 3 hours we are alternating between running a mile and swimming, you know, a buoy line at aquatic park or wherever. So we've really been seeing the value in kind of the consistency with that. Why is it that you two think, why do some people just only start to approach open water 2 weekends before their race to make sure their wetsuit fits them properly? Why is that a kind of the crux of the triathlete and swim runner, I'm sure, for some folks?
I think for the most part, that's probably naivete and not really knowing or understanding, or perhaps not being coached or not having the correct coach. So it's just a lack of awareness. And as you guys know, since that's what you're doing, you know that the moment you've exited the water from the swim segment and you stand up and start running, your heart rate's jacked up, right? You get this mm-hmm. this extra 10 or 15 beats a minute of spiked heart rate. So by practicing that also over and over from swim to run to swim to run and so on, run back to swim, you're also adapting to what's going to be race day environment. If you don't do that and then you go to the run swim, and you get done swimming and you start running, and you're going to stop after, you know, a short part of the run going, my God, what the hell happened? Am I sick today? So it's the specific demands of your event would call for certain training protocols so that you're properly prepared. And that's all it is. It's just being prepared for the event that you're going to do. Right. I mean, if the pole vaulter never showed up practice with the pole vault, what's the value of that practice given that their event is pole vaulting? So if you're going to be going from swimming to running, and that occurs obviously in a swim run, but also in a triathlon from the transition from the swim to the bike transition, mm-hmm. that requires a fair amount of adaptation also. If you want to have some sense of not necessarily luxury, but some sense of comfort with that transition, meaning, okay, I control the transition rather than the transition controlled me. You've trained for it. You're prepared for it. The body's well adapted to it. You're familiar with that heart rate spike. And it's like, okay, I've got this down. In fact, let me use this as a tool or an advantage over my fellow competitors. So it's just a specificity of training.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the Fs, right, Jerry, that we talk about in the book, the building familiarity and frequency in order to eliminate fear.
Right.
Ooh. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I think the way it's mentioned in the book, it's, you know, that's a process where you're moving from fear to familiarity, but that requires frequency. Is that am I paraphrasing that correctly?
You read correct. The book.
Yeah. did I pass the test? So how would you recommend, if you had to just summarize, I guess, like the open water chapter in your book, like how would you summarize going through those Fs? Like, obviously you need to be frequent, to try to be in there every week. What types of workouts should you be trying to do besides just getting used to cold water, getting used to currents and things like that?
So practice, you know, in anything that we're doing, and especially if we're going to be doing it for the first time, and once it's in water, there's going to be anxiety because that's normal human nature from the perspective of, and if it's open water, we have that innate fear system that's built into us from millions of years to make sure that we stay alive. So we have this slight anxiety. And if you don't have a swimming background, and I'm sure Emma Kay, perhaps, even though you had a tremendous swimming background, I would guess that you probably had a little bit of anxiety in some of our open water workouts in the beginning.
Yes, would that be right? For sure. Yes, definitely. It was something completely new, and I just didn't have a ton of familiarity with a lot of those conditions.
And that's a lack of, basically, it's another word for saying it's a lack of confidence, because I don't have the familiarity with it, so I'm uncertain. Mm-hmm. So that uncertainty, it creates the anxiety. So how do we reduce that? Well, we reduce it through practice, just doing something repetitively over and over, and then we start becoming familiar with it, and then it reduces our anxiety. The fear goes away or gets reduced quite a bit. So we move from the fear to the familiarity through frequency. And that would just mean practicing all the elements that you're going to be doing in your event. What is it like for the start of the event? The moment is that a land start or a water start? And then once you're actually in the water swimming, what's the next variable? Well, there's a whole bunch of people around you. Well, let's practice that. Let's make sure our sessions have a number of folks with us rather than just solo. And so we start getting adapted to people all around us. Then what's the next thing? Well, we have to be able to see buoys or where we're going. So let's practice sighting. So you go through, you know, very process-driven, step by step by step, what's going to happen during this particular segment. And if we practiced all the variables and we did it with a certain amount of repetition and frequency over a certain period of time, then adaptation occurs and therefore confidence is built. And we look at the swim as a weapon now rather than something to get through.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's definitely the journey I went on through my first season.
So it's funny. So I grew up, Jerry and I were talking about this for a show. I grew up in Puerto Rico and I learned to swim in the ocean, and pretty much that was my lap pool, and would spend 10 hours a day in the water without parental supervision. But this was the 80s, so it was fine back then. And I used to love triathlon swims because I love swimming in a pack. To me, that was so much fun. Yet pretty much everyone I knew, that was the thing they feared the most, was getting kicked in the face or getting someone swimming over them. And I always feel bad because I was like, oh, maybe I'm the person who's swimming
over
them.
Swim over you.
Like, I'm so sorry. But for me, my issue with open water, which was psychological, was cold, right? So moving to the Bay Area, the water is 60 degrees if we're lucky, 64
on a
max.
Good day, right.
Usually in the low 50s.
Yeah, usually in the 50s. And for me, it was a big mental thing, like getting into cold open water. I was like, well, I'm Puerto Rican. Like, I'm too warm blooded for this. I'm going to die. You know, that was my issue, was psychological. And I feel like your method deals with that too, right? It deals with swimming in a crowd. It deals with just being used to the elements. I mean, we've actually done a swim run in Maine where it would have been really helpful if we would have studied the currents.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, after the fact, it's like, oh yeah, we crossed the Portland Sound. That's a pretty strong current. Wish we would have known that. You know, so I feel like that part of it is there too. And I just really appreciated kind of the emphasis that you guys put on sort of the totality of the circumstances related to open water.
Yeah, I think any athlete that's going to participate in whatever the event may be, whether it's a swim run or a triathlon, and as it relates to the swimming segment, look at the variables that are you're going to be exposed to during their event. So let's say you're going to have super cold water, and you grew up in Puerto Rico or in Trinidad like I did, and I don't think there's ever a day where the water is below 80 degrees in the ocean.
It's bath water. It's bath water.
Exactly. And you're going to be in 60 degree water. Well, guess what? I remember when I swam around Manhattan and the water was going to be in the 60s, I had to take cold showers, ice baths, a number of things to get my body familiar with cold water because I was going to be in it for 8 hours. So if I just showed up on event day to swim around Manhattan with no practice of being in cold water for any sustainable period of time, that wouldn't have been a successful outcome. So we have to identify the variables and then simply become adapted to them.
You know, if you want to hear a super quick, funny story, you know, as mentioned, Jerry and I were used to growing up in bathwater. When my family moved to Massachusetts when I was 12, my brother and I were kind of bummed out. So their bright idea was to take us to the beach. So they drove us down to Cape Cod. My brother and I were really excited. Before they even stopped the car, we're jumping out and running straight into the ocean. And my parents come out and my brother and I are shivering, holding each other on the beach. And we had never experienced cold. Like, we didn't know it was we just didn't even know what cold saltwater ocean was. So we just ran in just assuming it was going to be the same. And it was the coldest, scariest thing. So maybe that's – thank you. I just had a breakthrough of my therapy with you guys on the show.
But, you saved him thousands of dollars in therapy bills.
But yeah, it was crazy.
That's pretty funny. It's like when the tourists come to San Francisco and it's July and they think it's going to be summer with the shorts and the t-shirt, but they forgot about all the fog. I'd like to dive in a little bit here. So one big difference between triathlon and swim run is triathlon, if you're doing, you know, Olympic, half, Ironman, whatever, the swim distance is fixed every time. And that's a fixed training thing that you can train for, you know, 1.2 miles or whatever the distance is. In a swim run, there's variance from course to course. So there's literally no course to where it's going to be the same. So when you kind of approach your training in the pool or maybe even open water, let's say, for example, we did the Otola Catalina earlier this year at the end of February. And in totality, it had about 5Ks of swimming against 18 miles of running. And there was probably 8 or 9 transitions or 8 or 9 legs of each. Some swims being as short as 400 yards and some being 16, 17, 1800 yards. So I'd be curious to hear how you two would kind of prescribe a, in broad strokes, kind of a training plan for a swim run with that much variability in it.
So I think the first thing that you have to start with is look at the duration of the event. And in this case, you talked about, I believe, at least 5 kilometers of swimming.
Yeah, yes. So like total distance.
And that actually seems relatively short compared to, I believe, the one that you did back east where I think it was
10,000.
Yeah, 10K.
That was 10K.
Okay. So the place to start is you need to be able to actually do the distance. So 1.2 miles in a triathlon is paltry relative to 5 kilometers in a run swim or 10 kilometers in the other one that you guys did. So there needs to be a whole lot more foundation in place for swimming. Mm-hmm. Simplistically said, swim more. Okay, let's make it really simple.
Yeah.
You need to do more swimming than you're used to, given if you were only doing 1.2 half Ironman distances as an example, or Olympic distances.
Let me squeeze another quick question in there. And when you say more swimming, more frequency or longer duration, or probably both?
So in the ideal world, both. Mm-hmm. But if you only had one, just more. Just make sure the volume within the week is greater. So if you've typically been swimming 5,000 yards a week, well, let's find a way to gradually increase that to whatever the amount that your time allows for. But definitely, so that's the foundation, because you need to be able to, you don't want to do training and then show up in race day and pay fees and hotel accommodations and airfare and whatever else, and then you can't complete the race because you couldn't do the swim segment. So the foundation is make sure that you're able to handle the distance of the swim. So that just comes from more frequency and greater volume. And then the specificity of it comes in after that, which would be, well, we have to have running integrated. And then after we run, we have to be able to swim again. So then the dynamics of the workouts need to be structured in such a way, and you guys nailed it earlier on, you already have that built into your training regime each week where you go to aquatic park and you swim whatever distance you do, and then you exit and you run and you come back in. So you're building that in. That would be part of a normal protocol for anyone that's doing run swim events. So you must be able to integrate those transitions, because it's a constant transitional race, correct?
Mm, yep.
Yes.
So it's not going to be the traditional, well, today I'm just going to work on my swim, or my morning workout is swimming, my evening workouts, I'm on the bike,
right,
for a triathlon, and then the next day I'll run. Here you're going to have more of your sessions integrated with, I would think, with more transitions built in, because that's the dynamic nature of that particular event. It's heavily transitioned.
That just goes so great and in line with kind of everything that you've been saying this entire episode, is that there's not a silver bullet. Your book doesn't have, you know, chapter 5 isn't how to be faster with 10 minutes a week. It's you just have to do the work, and it has to be consistent. And that's, I guess, the beauty of it. And it's like, if you're ready to embrace that or adjust your mindset to tackle that, then this is the perfect book for you, because it lays it out how to be a better swimmer. You know, there's no secrets. You just swim more.
And also don't complicate it. I mean, we don't have to go beyond, don't overanalyze this. In the specific case of swimming and run events, don't make this anything bigger more than it is. Here's what I got to do. Here's what the event calls upon. And what are the needs of this event? And then lay out a training plan specific to those needs. Here's a correlation in triathlon swimming. So many times I see athletes doing things in at pools, and I could tell they're triathlete because they have a swim cap on that says whatever, San Francisco Triathlon.
Yeah.
So you know they've, and it still has a number on it. So they raced last weekend, example, and they're wearing their race cap still. And they're at the pool and they're doing a number of drills. And swimming drills that are completely non-correlated to anything that they would do in open water. That's the first thing. And then the second thing, the drill is so far advanced, there's absolutely zero benefit that they're garnering from that drill. So one, they're sucking up valuable time because they only have a fixed amount of time each week, and they've decided to spend a certain amount of that time doing drills. So now you've really erased that time. You may as well just stay at home. And then number two, you're doing a drill that has no application to the event that you're doing. So keep it super tailored and very targeted.
Love that. I actually have a question for Emma Kate here about gear and kind of and toys. And I'm sure as a pro triathlete and being a lifelong swimmer, you have probably seen or used every single swim paddle or snorkel or whatever that has ever been created in the history of swimming. So Jerry, and in the book, there's several tools recommended. I'd be curious, Emma Kate, if you can kind of touch on your top three tools for working on maybe if it's technique or being a better open water swimmer. And you have a whole chapter kind of on this stuff. So what's your top three tools and why? Swim tools.
Oh yeah, I mean the swimmer's tool bag, the swimmer's kit bag is always, or the triathlete's kit bag is always full, and the triathlete always, and I think swim runners too, always have their buoy, right? I think the buoy is the go-to. But actually, my close second is a good pair of fins, because that really, I mean, for a ton of reasons, but I mean, obviously helping develop speed, helping develop feel for the water, helping develop good body position, helping you recover. You know, as swim runners, if you've done big run workouts and you want to go to the pool the next day and get a decent swim in, then fins are definitely going to help you, especially in that first kind of, maybe in your first kind of prep set or even just warm up, just loosen out the legs a little bit that you get, you definitely get those heavy legs from doing a lot of running. And my third would probably be a tie between good paddles and the front mounted snorkel. The snorkel is great in terms of, but if we go back to talking about chapter 4 and the technique and all the technical work that sort of underpins, making any kind of progress, I think the snorkel is is that one piece of kit that really allows you to focus on technique, because you don't have to worry about breathing, or you don't have to worry about turning your head to breathe, rather.
Right.
Yeah, I've been using the snorkel, and I was a Purple Patch Fitness who Matt Dixon and Jerry, I think, share a lot of the same kind of methodologies and everything. But yeah, Dixon prescribed a very very thick swim bag for us. But the snorkel was one, and you don't think about it at the time, but thinking of breathing, oh, is it every three? Is it every two? Like, you don't get a focus on if you're working on your entry or whatever your focus is for that particular set or whatever you're doing. Just removing that variable is so freeing, and really the focus you have is so intense on that one thing that you're working on, and you touch on that a lot in the book, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, I think when you're wearing a snorkel, you can think about where are my hands entering the water? You know, where's my head? How's my body position? Without having to worry about turning your head, because it's when you turn your head that a lot of the problems can begin.
Yeah.
Or when you over rotate your head, or if you keep moving your head.
And I also appreciate it in the book. Sorry, Chris, I know you were edging in there. You showed photos of what something bad looks like, because that's very helpful. Rather than just showing it's good, everyone's like, yeah, I think I kind of do that. But then when you look at the bad one or how not to do it, I'm like, oh, actually, I think I'm closer to this guy than the really perfect one.
That's really important, right? Because a lot of people know what they should be aspiring to, but don't always know, like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? And Jerry has some very clear, clear ideas and clear examples of this is how not to do it. So I think, and then, using images like that makes it very, very simple for people to determine straight away whether they're doing it right or wrong.
Okay. So I have one last question. Have you guys ever heard of the term fartlek swimming?
Well, I've heard of fartlek, but not fartlek swimming.
Okay, cool.
That sounds like fun, though.
So,
our
second guest of the show, Michael Lozinski, I think I was trying to figure out of Purple Patch if he invented that term. So I just wanted to ask other swim coaches, because I was like, "What are you talking about, dude?" Yeah, fartlek swimming,
you just make up how far you want to swim and how fast.
Exactly, which is kind of mentioned in the book as a technique to learn in open water how to change speeds and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think, I just wanted to see so I can give him some shit about it later.
That would be pretty hard, though, because, like when you're fartlek running and you're running with somebody, you can say, hey, okay, like to that lamppost or to that mailbox. But when you're swimming, how does that work?
Oh, I guess
to that boat.
This is really specific to aquatic park, maybe.
Yeah.
Hey, look at all these boats or this buoy, or if you have a more structured open water.
Or do like strokes, like count 50 strokes or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You do it with stroke counts, or a certain number of strokes, and then you also you can set your watch, whatever your device is, to vibrate every certain amount of time. Let's say you set it every 2 minutes as an example.
Oh, I like that.
You can go 2 minutes at a certain effort and then 2 minutes of recovery. So there are ways to do it, but... do give him shit anyway.
Thank you.
We all know him really well. And
we want to thank you guys so much for being on the show. The book is called Triathlon Swimming, Master Open Water Swimming with the Tower 26 Method. Definitely encourage people checking it out. It's a VeloPress book. You can find it wherever you get books. And thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having
us. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate the invite.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Low Tide Boys, a swim run podcast. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast and leave a review on iTunes if you're so inclined.
You can also sign up for our newsletter at lowtideboys.com. That's boys with a Z. And check out our meme page at The Low Tide Boys on Instagram. If you have any questions or suggestions for the show, drop us an email at lowtideboys@gmail.com.
We'd like to thank Writing Easy Records for our show music, and of course our wives for their support and tolerance of our swim run activities, hobbies, and other bullshit we do.
Finally, you can support our efforts on Patreon. Until next time, get out there and go for a swim.
And then a run.
And then another swim.
Then another run.
And then another swim.
And then run to the finish line and just keep going until you're done.
Yes,
or until run to the finish line.
Or run to the car.
Or run to your car.
Somewhere. Just keep running.
Peace.